Hello, and welcome to another episode of Eat, Eat, Eat.
Hello.
I don't usually do the intro, do
I? No, I think you're doing it from now on. That was that was beautiful. That was like a calming meditation podcast.
Yeah, we could start a side podcast. Podcast.
Oh, food and psychology.
It's yeah. Like,
take a bite of the chicken wing.
Or just all ASMR. Just, I like it. I like the chicken wing.
And then the crunch of the chicken wing.
I'm sorry, but it's already been done. I think KFC released a fried chicken meditation thing.
Look, if anyone but KFC did it, I would have been fuming. But as the number one KFC fan of the world, it's okay.
It's okay.
So that's like KFC. Here's a question for you, Brian. KFC, fine dining or is it cheap food?
It's more than fine. It's super delicious. But no, it's not.
It's a cheap eat.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And I guess that's what we wanted to focus on today. Because,
but I like, okay, yeah. Here's where I, sorry to interrupt.
Yes,
but okay. Like, can something be fine dining and cheap? Like, can something be fine dining purely off how good it tastes? Or is fine dining more, does that... You have to take in about the price and the setting. I just get really confused about this, like, what is fine, what is cheap eats, you know? It's...
I think the term fine dining, and I don't know this exactly, but it denotes a certain level of process and produce and... maybe cuisine as well. I mean, obviously, like the degustation and the fine dining scene in Europe, I guess, and in Australia is a lot based on the French model and the kind of the classic French training. So I guess fine dining in its definition comes from that lineage. But apart from those aspects, I guess we're talking about enjoyment and flavor. And I guess those things are very subjective. So,
yeah, exactly.
It's, yeah.
Because I guess on this recent trip I did, I actually did sample both. I know I'm like I think I usually would lean towards the cheap eats and the... I've had so many great experiences with cheap eats over the years and that I, you know... And in terms of finances, it's much more accessible as well. But I did do both. Like, I was just thinking like... Right near the beginning of my trip, like we did a stopover in Thailand and like instantly I was eating. Like that's the definition of cheap eats. Like a lot of the food there was like street side. There was some that were like 30 Australian cents for like a small bowl of soup. Small portions of soup, by the way. What a great thing. Like the Japanese ramen needs to come in like just a tiny, like the size of like a cappuccino cup.
Yep, I agree. I completely. That's my favorite thing about a lot of, particularly Southeast Asian places.
Yeah, like Thai, like, you know, like Doody Bedang does like the half size and it's exactly half price of the full portion. Like,
yeah, full disclosure. It's the, yeah, that's the best because, yeah, I mean, it can be a snack or it means you can order more things. At Doody Bedang, the best thing to get is the quail eggs with the deep fried wonton shell with it off the chain. But yeah, it's the perfect excuse for that post-work 5 p.m. hunger pang, and it's the best.
Like you can't go to like get a ramen for that because you'll just be knocked out for the next 24 hours. But
yeah, mini ramen is the way to go.
Mini ramen, let's invent it. But I'm just thinking of like the first meal, this soup I had in Thailand. I like we got there, we got to our hotel. As I do, I just gravitate to the nearest street food, especially in, I was so excited to be in Southeast Asia. I don't know what, I'd been a long time since I'd been there. And yeah, just went and found a stall on the street, quite busy with locals, always a good sign.
Yep.
Didn't know what it was. It's some sort of soup. And I took a sip, got it. And it was just like beautiful, complex flavors, like fine dining flavors that I, you know, I was just, really like subtle but refreshing almost. Mm-hmm. Turns out it was like a pork blood soup. And it did have all the bits.
Mm.
I know you're a fan of chucking all the bits in a soup.
Yeah, that's what a soup's for, right? It's to use up everything that you've got in the fridge.
Yeah, so you know, like all the like intestine, everything was in there. Mm. But just incredible flavors. And then it just sticks in my head because I had that mind blown. I had a lot of those experiences in Bangkok, actually. Mm. Just constantly incredible dishes. And then I actually did the definition of like the stereotypical, if you think of what a stereotypical fine dining experience is, I did that in Berlin. Mm. It was incredible. Like I got my girlfriend, Beck, bought this as a birthday present for me before we'd even booked our flights to Europe. And it was just the most incredible gesture. Mm. I don't know if she quite knew what we were getting into. I think she was like, oh, I've heard this is nice. And then it was like full on fine dining. Like we're talking about like bowls coming out that had like dry ice in them. Like this kind of Heston Blumenfeld, like everything was like just an experience.
Mm.
It was very foreign to me. I was out of my element. There were a few moments where I was just like almost, I'd had a few too many nice glasses of wine, but like I was just losing my shit. Like I just didn't know how to act.
Yeah.
Like they put this dish down and it's smoking, like there's dry ice going off and I'm just like clapping like a small child. Well, it was the thing that blew my mind in this situation was looking around at that restaurant and every single other person there was just very seriously taking in the food like it was a normal experience. Like, I found that hard. That bothered me.
I think what you're alluding to is the fact that fine dining has a certain set of social rules and expectations. And obviously, because you're forking out a significant sum of money, I think there's higher stakes than just eating at play. So I think people enter into this social contract or this almost this social drama or play where they feel like they need to respond in a certain way. It sounds like you had no kind of sense.
I was surprised I wasn't like shown out to be honest. But it was more, I was just more bothered. Like you're spending all this money. The food was delicious. It like really clever interpretations on things. Like there was a dish that came out that I was like, I don't even know what this looks like. But then when I ate it, it was like a take almost on the curryverse. Like it had flavor of the curryverse, but done in like a really incredible way with great produce.
And
a lot of that sort of playing with your senses where you're like, why do I know that flavor? And you go, that to me, you're meant to be reacting and enjoying yourself. But I looked around and everyone was just nodding their head like, yeah, this is a normal Friday night for me. I do this like every week. And maybe they do like that every week. But I found that hard. I felt a little bit out of place almost. But what about you? Are you into the fine dining thing? I used to like, I don't know, I feel we used to be on the same page. But the amount of, you've been dropping some names in recent episodes. I think you've switched sides.
I mean, I think as I've gotten into food and to chefs, that has kind of made me more interested in fine dining, and I've ended up going to one maybe every couple of months or for special occasions in the past couple of years. But inevitably, I'm a little bit disappointed, and maybe it's that price point thing, where when you pay that much, there's a high level of expectation, so it's hard to meet those expectations. But as you were talking before about that process, whereby there's clever dishes or there's that kind of trickery happening, I was thinking that's novel and that's cool. But I think the thing that it is really important in food is some sense of connection and narrative and in the kind of corny cliche sense, some sense of love and genuineness. And I think that's where a lot of perhaps fine dining gets lost. It gets lost in the trickery, in the molecular gastronomy, and in those kind of clever
twists and turns. If like the they're doing that sort of thing where there is this like trick or there's this twist. I guess if that takes you back to a meal that you had forgotten about or something, then I guess you start getting in that personal experience. Like,
yeah.
I guess, wasn't there a place that did like the, what's it called? Like the cereal milk
dish
or something.
Yeah,
like
that's Momofuku.
Yeah, like the Momofuku. You know, and I guess that is a thing where it might not be something that people have thought about in many years and they go, oh, actually, like that was a special thing to me. So
yeah. So I think that's perhaps where some of the really great restaurants have really succeeded, is that they're able to balance those emotional, soulful elements with the more technical aspects of cooking. But yeah, I think I do have a weird relationship with fine dining because I always seek them out. But maybe, I don't know, I can be a pessimistic person at times, and maybe I'm just setting myself up to fail. But I think Cheap Eats will always be number one in my heart because that's what I grew up eating. And I think there's that kind of mum and pop feel of those restaurants and the lack of pretension, which is really, really attractive.
Yeah, I guess for me, that's probably what holds me back the most is the pretension. Like, I think of the comparison of like, we've mentioned Chinese noodle restaurant or Chinese noodle house, like the two different restaurants, but they're all owned by the same dumpling mafia. That's a whole other podcast. But you know, you get these restaurants around, like these Chinese restaurants, the Cheap Eats. There is zero pretension there. It's kind of like, get in here, we're going to give you some tasty food, and we're going to put the bill down on your table before you're done, because this is about efficiency. But I love that. Like, I just like, I'm not needing, you know, really friendly service in that moment. It feels genuine, at least. And sometimes I go to fine dining places, and there's nothing that drives me more insane than just the forced service and the which is, it's a skill. Like, I have been to some more like, you know, fine dining places where the staff are able to just come across as natural and casual, but that's you know, it's a performance still. Like, they're not choosing to be there and hang out. Like, that's their job. So it's you think?
Well, I'm not the most prolific fine diner, but I mentioned this restaurant in most episodes of this podcast. I mentioned it last week. So Momofuku Seibo, which is now kind of in the Caribbean, guys, as we said last week.
I think we need
to
like have a counter for your Momofuku mentions.
Well, they've followed up our podcast. Which
what?
Is, yeah, I forgot to tell you. They followed us. So that's pretty much like podcast highlight.
Yeah, and then thank you for joining us on Eat, Eat, Eat. It's now over.
Yeah, that's
right. We can't give it other than that.
Yeah, that's true.
I love fine dining, by the way, if you're listening.
You just want a free meal now.
Yes.
But that's an example of a place where you go, when I go in there, you feel like that they've known you for ages and they remember what's happening in your life. So like they'll remember that I have a daughter or that I was doing this and that. So it does feel like coming home, and they've talked about that vibe being really important, is that you should feel like you're coming home or it's a family vibe. So that's not something that all fine dining restaurants aspire to or achieve. Dave Chang, the head honcho of Momofuku, said that Kylie Harvey Ashton, who's their head general manager there, is the best in the business, and it shows because she's so chill and so cool, but she's consummately professional as well. So it's a really tough task to be professional but also chilled and cool and casual, and I think that's why so many restaurants struggle sometimes, because it's a hard thing to do.
I think from what I've seen, there are more, and I think maybe, I don't know the statistics, but like, I think fine dining's having to almost reinvent itself a little bit. You see a lot of these fine dining restaurants actually shutting down, like the traditional, you know, really proper service and the constantly looking over your shoulder. And now it seems to be maybe moving towards a more casual feel because I think people want to just go and have a good time when they eat out. It's like no longer about this, like, I want to impress someone or... I've had a few of those experiences which are really super casual vibe, but then the food is, you know... Again, I will buy into fine. I'm happy to call something fine dining and pay the money if I'm being like introduced to new flavors or, yeah, like you're saying, like having a personal connection. And you know, and the as long as and if the produce is, if I'm paying for the produce, you know, then that's, yeah, I get it. But yeah, definitely the service thing for me, I was put off fine dining because of, you know, that vibe and the stereotype of fine dining. But you can see the switch happening now. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think there's been a couple of different elements that have led to that shift from typical fine dining into something different. I mean, again, I don't know like heaps and heaps about it, but there's a movement in Paris called, I think, bistronomy. So basically, instead of having these really formal fine dining settings, you have a more casual dining setting with maybe less courses, less degustations, but more accessible, more of a neighborhood restaurant. So I think that's really influenced cuisines around the world and cities of dining. So yeah, we see that here. A lot of the fine dining chefs that have previously worked at two or three hat restaurants are now opening their own places that are more casual, are expressing more of their own history and maybe of their ethnicity. It's been said, and yeah, chefs say that they want their friends and family to be able to eat at their restaurant and be able to afford it and not feel awkward. So I think also part of this is the change in fine dining kitchen culture. So the classic stereotype of a kitchen is that it's quite aggressive, very male dominated.
You know, Gordon Ramsay is yelling at you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, throwing plates across the room, blah, blah, blah. But I think part and parcel of that shift is having kitchens that are more relaxed, open kitchens.
Also, I was about to say, yeah, the open kitchen is become a thing, you know, looking straight in. I've had a few awkward encounters with open kitchens, though, where I've seen that old school style happening. And there was one... Actually, I'm going to just say where it was. I think they've now sold their cafe anyway. Okay. But at Two Chaps in Marrickville. It's not fine dining, you know, but really was great quality food. But they had the open kitchen and it was often so busy that you had to sit at the bar. So you're sitting right there looking at the kitchen. You know, that's cool. I was excited about that. I wasn't, you know, pumped to see a chef like tearing apart someone who looked like, you know, a dish, like an assistant chef. Just that lack of awareness, as my girlfriend and I sat there too, just seeing, yeah, like we're literally 20 centimeters away.
Yeah.
It's like he's right in our face as I think he said something along the lines of, if you fuck up again, you're out of, like, you're seriously out of here. And like, it was like,
okay.
I know. And like, maybe this guy was stuffing up, but I'm guessing now, maybe these open kitchens are almost forcing a change in that behavior because you can no longer tear someone apart like that.
Yeah.
Because people are going to go like, hey, that's not cool and I don't want to eat here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that does help with that. I mean,
don't sue me, Two Chaps. I love you.
Look, I think kitchens are high stress environments and it's really hard work. And I think the culture of kitchens, I mean, I relate this to trauma in families, and oftentimes when someone has gone through a traumatic experience in their family or a traumatic experience in their first job and in their cooking internship, wherever they are, then they internalize those values. And when that comes their time to parent or to become a mentor in a kitchen, they're most likely to repeat that cycle. So I think it's something that, again, is increasingly coming on the radar of kitchens. You know, this is not an easy answer for the industry because it's not just about being nice and changing your attitude. It's about changing the working conditions of the kitchen in general. So I know that I think Attica in Melbourne, which is, you know, one of the best restaurants in Australia, they changed their dining hours and perhaps when they were open so that their staff could have more time off so they could recuperate. And they could be well in the kitchen. So
because it's legitimately it's hard work. Like I've worked in lots of kitchens, and It's a bit of a shit job. Mm. Like, really, if you like break down the characteristics of like usually like being a chef is long hours, bad hours, like, you know, early hours in the morning, often late. The actual physical environment of like it's hot, you get covered in like you sometimes see lots of chefs and they got like oil burns on their arms and you know it's and then your pay is not great often. It's like it's this weird thing and I've you know had a friend who was running a you know quite a successful cafe and to now find a good chef is getting harder and harder because less and less people want to do it. So yeah, it's you know improving the conditions and especially in these fine dining establishments like where you'd hope you'd be able to pay your staff properly and stuff like that. I guess that's a really positive thing.
Yeah, and I think that's the big perhaps the elephant in the room in this discussion is that when you're paying cheap prices for your food, thinking about who's actually paying for the cheapness of the meal and where why is it so cheap? And typically it's because someone's getting burnt, either the
don't
supplier.
Take these away from me, Brian. I was ignorant. No, but I'm absolutely with you.
Yeah. And yeah, it's a really big dilemma. But I think the thing that we can take away from it is to know that it's okay and it's reasonable to pay a decent price for good food.
I guess as long as it's hard to know though because
it's so hard
this is like this argument with you know ethical like you know with clothing and you're like oh you don't want to buy from Kmart because they you know have factories in Bangladesh but I guess it's all about that awareness because you can buy a brand for $200 more that has the same ethical values.
Gosh.
So I guess yeah it's we almost need a registrar, like a you know a guide to be like a shame. You know how they have the hygiene stars on the door when either like actually but I guess they don't you know no restaurant is like staying open if they are like paying their staff. Well they are clearly but it's a really fascinating thing and I guess yeah again maybe if I knew that information, if I was certain that like people are getting paid more, like better, I'm willing to spend more money. And now you're just feeling so guilty about all the places that I eat that the staff are probably being paid nothing. Damn you, Brian.
Yeah.
No,
yes.
Actually, but thank you. I needed that.
Yeah. It's one of those things that we have to sit with as a consumer. But I think as long as we be as informed as we can and as long as we do the best we can with the money we have, then we can't do much more than that. You know, at the end of the day, we're feeding ourselves, and it's fuel. At the end of the day, it's not a purely ethical decision as much. You know, we can try and include ethical decision making as much as we can, but there's only so much we can do.
All right, I'm gonna throw you under a bus here.
Sure.
Top three cheap eats in Sydney.
I think, yeah, we talked about Doo Dee Padang.
With the half-size bowl?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. So that's a tom yum noodle soup. It's got a whole variety.
Do you get the combination? I often get the combination one. What do you get in?
Is it a combination? There's a whole bunch of stuff in it. There's like the beef bowl and the soft rib. And
yeah, I think at least at the one in Bondi Junction, you ask for the combination.
Yeah. So that's great. Most pork roll places.
Yeah, I was gonna say, pork roll.
A good pork roll place. Favorite cheap eat. I mean, that's the thing. It's like $5 or $10 for a cheap eat. I really like other Vietnamese like noodle soups, like a bong bo hue or Tan Viet in Eastwood. Crispy skin chicken.
Another shout out.
Yeah, I was there the other day.
Okay, would you be more excited for Tan Viet to follow you on Instagram or Momifoku?
It'd be close. It's pretty close.
Yeah, I will say, and I think I need to know if it's still open. The best ever like thing, cheap meal that made me question this whole debate was a restaurant we ate in Ashfield in Sydney called Taste Tetrahedron.
Oh, yeah.
That was was it China? Where in China was it?
I think it was
from
Sichuan, yeah.
Yeah, Sichuan and like, but just every dish there just blew my mind.
It wasn't the cheap, like super cheap. It was like 20, 25 dollar main dishes, yeah.
But that was a main that fed could feed four people. Yeah. Like an entire
pork knuckle.
Pork knuckle. And that was just one of those moments where I was like, oh my God, like, this is fine dining, but I'm not paying the fine dining price and I'm not in a fine dining establishment.
Yeah.
Is that still open or is it shut?
No, it's shut. I tried to speak to BQ about it and tried to source another restaurant like it, but no, it's not there. There's not much like it. But I think that that's what we touched on last week. Like, I think finding novel flavors and interesting cuisines that can give you a great experience. Yeah. More than, you know,
like if you're priced out of fine dining,
yeah,
you've got options out there.
Yeah, totally. It's just about finding something that will tantalize and give you that kind of wow moment.
Yeah, be willing to travel as well in Sydney, I think, as well. Like if you're happy to spend 45 minutes to an hour on a train, you can get a really authentic experience and like be able to experience some new flavors.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Levins, who's doing the writing for Good Food now, he always talks about the Cabramatta tour.
Yep.
I think that he talks about the Cabramatta Happy Meal. It's like a chicken roll from KK Bakery, getting chips from Red Lee and a sugarcane juice. But yeah, Cabramatta is such a wonderful place to travel and escape. But there's so many other little suburban ethnic hubs, which is just, I don't know, it's such a wonderful part of being in Sydney.
But are there any places there to eat like food at 2 a.m., 3 a.m.? Because I reckon next week I've decided you've got no choice. This is now a dictatorship. But late night food. Because they've announced there's going to be a new 24-hour precinct Sydney. And it's just got me thinking about and I'm from traveling. Everywhere I've been, you can get food at any time of day and Sydney's a bit lacking on that front, I think. So maybe next week, have a think about that. See if you can find out if there's any 24-hour restaurant in the likes of Cabramatta, and then I'm sold.
It's probably more likely you just find a Vietnamese grandma who's got insomnia, to treat her insomnia, she cooks up an amazing pho or something.
All right.
Just go to her place.
Let's go. All right, cool. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Instagram, just like Mama Foku does.
Yeah.
Eat, eat, eat.
That's what all the cool kids are doing.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Next time on Eat, Eat, Eat.
Bye.